The Catholic Channel, Sirius 159, and XM 117 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love, just do it. Just love God, just love yourself, and just love your neighbor, and our world will be more just, and it will be more compassionate. You know, it's funny, we use that word love in a variety of ways. Obviously, there is the romantic sense of the word love, the sexual sense of the word love, the emotional sense of the word love. We use love to embrace what is, we consider so important, Christian love, which is basically modeled after the love of Jesus, in which Jesus gave his life for us on the cross, redeemed us, and his death on the cross then leads 3 days later to the resurrection and the transformation of all life. So when we use the word love, we use it in that very, very life-giving, that very caring for the other. And one of the things that I like to say, because for years I've said, well, so what does it mean to love in our sense? And basically, what love means in my little definition of the world is love means willing, wanting the best for the other person. So if I love someone, I want the best for that person. I want their humanity to be fulfilled. I want them to be happy. And acts of love are those loves which make another person happy, which make another person fulfilled, which look out for the neighbor. And so when we say just love, we basically mean just looking out for the good of others, looking out for their good, wanting them to be happy, wanting them to be fulfilled. And so when we say that, when we say just love, we also mean a little bit of justice, that we want to arrange our world in a way in which there is fairness, in which things are arranged so that everybody has the basics that they need to fulfill themselves, to be happy, to live in dignity. So when we talk about love and justice, a critical part of wanting the best for the other person is making sure that their basic human needs are met, that they can live in happiness, they can live in fulfillment. And then we also say love in the sense of compassion, too. We say it because I sometimes will the best for another. I want the best for a neighbor. Even if I can't remake the whole world to be just, in the midst of the injustice of the world, people suffer. And so when I say love, what I mean also is I have to help to alleviate some of that suffering on an individual level. So that's why at Catholic Charities we have emergency food programs. Emergency food programs don't make the world just, but they're a reflection of Christian love, because when there is injustice, we need to want the best for another person and help that person alleviate their suffering so they can live their lives in a little bit more dignity, even if the whole world around isn't completely fair and completely just. So when we say just love, we mean only love. It's just about love. And it's about justice, too. So it's compassion, it's justice, it's fairness. It's looking at how we make our whole world better and how we deal with individuals made in God's image and likeness to make sure that their lives are a bit, little bit better. Hey, Tom, I think I went on too long to begin.
No, Monsignor, I think that was a beautiful, beautiful statement about what the show's about.
That's what we're about, and that's why we talk with kind of interesting people who have their own take on what we need to do to make our world more just, to make it more compassionate. Angie, how are you doing this week?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
Good. You look rather perky this week. Are you alive and well and everything?
Yes.
Good.
Are you saying that I looked bad last week?
Okay. Since you brought it up, I didn't say it, but you know, if you're
senior.
If you're self-disclosing, that's okay. You look particularly perky.
Well, thank you. But I was talking to you earlier. I want to hear about the apples.
Okay. So, I've got to give you a background to the apples, okay?
Please do.
Okay, a little background to the apples. Because one of the reasons why I'm not so perky today, I'm wimpy, because I got a cold from picking apples. Because I was out and it was cold. But anyway, so I'm a little wimpy today, okay? And, but having said that, so I went apple picking last week. And I go, as I have for the past 5 or 6 years, with my cousin to this orchard in
Connecticut, Washington, I think it's Washington, Connecticut. Now, I got to tell you, I feel a little bit guilty being a New Yorker because I think you should pick apples in New York. But anyway, Connecticut, New York, they come together. My cousin lives in Connecticut, but this is a great place to go pick apples.
Mm.
Great place because, I'm not telling the name because then everybody's going to go there,
that's
okay?
Right.
But it's a great place to pick apples because the apple orchard goes back to, I think it goes back to the 18th century.
Wow.
So it goes back a long, long time. So it's been there in these acres and acres in kind of rural Connecticut. And it's not very commercial. So in other words, some of the apple picking stuff. Angie, have you gone apple picking yet?
I have never been apple picking.
Okay, next year you got to come apple picking.
I will.
Okay, you
it's
come
fun.
You come
in Connecticut or New York?
Uh-huh. Either one.
Which one's better?
Well, they're both good.
Okay.
They're both good. Okay.
Okay.
So when apple picking, but actually it's become such a big thing that they try to make it into a lot of fun for kids and entertainment, but some of it they overdo.
Like and, what?
Well, I mean, they have like little hay rides, they have pumpkin patches, they have clowns.
That sounds like fun. Wait, clowns?
Yeah.
Ugh, never mind.
You don't like clowns?
I do not like clowns.
Yeah, I don't like clowns either.
Are you a sourpuss?
Not at all.
Then how come you don't like clowns?
I've just seen that movie, is it called It by Stephen King?
I know the book. I've never seen the movie, but I think the book is about a scary clown.
There's something about a clown that is just the face makeup, I think.
Okay. All right. Okay. So no clowns. But anyway, but what they do is kind of they like make it all this kind of commercial stuff and all of those type of things, which is fun and all. But if you go apple picking, you go to pick apples.
Of course.
Right. Not a lot of the other stuff that gets surrounding it. So that's why I like this place, because it's not so commercial.
Mm.
It's just rows and rows and rows and rows of apple trees. And you just kind of, actually, and they give you, this is great. They give you a little wagon that you can kind of drag.
I love that.
A little wagon that you can drag. And so you drag the wagon down the various rows of apple trees.
Mm.
And you pick your apples and you put them in the wagon.
That sounds nice.
Do you eat the apples right there and then, or do you wash them, take them home?
Well, okay, here's what my cousin and I do, because is they're all different kinds of apples. So they're probably like, 15 different varieties of apples.
Then how do you know which one's which?
Well, you kind of either do a little research, but the better way to do it is, as you go down the rows, you pick one and you take a bite.
Mm.
And you decide whether you like it or not, whether you how many of those you want and stuff like that. So some of them are real tart. Some of them are real sweet. Some of them are yellow. Most of them are red. Some of them are green.
Mm.
So there are all these different types of apples that there are. And you go down the row and you put them in your cart. And you got bags in the cart, too. And then you've done your apple picking. And it's great.
That sounds so fresh and very different from going to the grocery store. Are any of them really bruised, or are they all just really nice apples?
Well, you don't
pick
the bruised ones.
You don't pick the bruised ones.
No.
Well, I guess you...
Right. That's why you go and pick your own. I mean, come on. But actually, some of them are bruised, some of them not bruised.
Sure.
No, most of them are. They're on the trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... And I don't think they go to waste, because even the ones who fall off and are on the ground, I think then they use them for some type of...
Or little critters can eat it.
Little critters
right,
can eat it.
Absolutely.
Little critters. So it's a great, great thing. And when I went the past week, it wasn't too crowded. Now, I'll give you a little bit of a tip, okay?
Okay.
A little tip for apple picking.
Ooh, insider information.
Insider information. You don't go on the Columbus Day weekend.
Yeah.
Because that's when everybody goes.
Oh, yeah. Do most people have off on Monday on Columbus Day?
A lot of people do. A lot of people do. So, and the other little tip, so you don't go on that weekend, but if you really want the good apple picking, you go a week or so before then.
Mm.
Because the orchards and everything's are depleted after Columbus Day.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, because
everyone goes and everyone takes it.
So
it's too late for me to go, probably?
No, you can go. You can still go, but I mean... First time, you got to learn a little bit. You can go. And
I'm getting schooled here.
Yes, you can go. But you're probably going to have to reach up a little bit higher
I'll bring my ladder.
Bring your ladder, and you're probably going to have to walk down to the end of the orchard rows, because the beginning part, people have picked those trees clean.
Okay.
So that's what you do. You go down. Now, do you like applesauce?
Not really. I like apple pie.
Apple pie? All right.
Applesauce is the texture.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're the second person. Somebody else I know doesn't like applesauce. Most people love applesauce. So, but you like apple pie?
Oh, love it. I love it.
All right. So, we'll see what we'll do in terms of making, because I still got apples. I got tons of apples that are left. So,
do any of them have worms in it?
No. I wouldn't pick the ones that have worms in them. Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
You've never been into an apple and there's been a worm?
I never have.
What?
He never has good apples.
He chooses
good apples.
I think I choose bad ones.
Well, I mean,
I pick the ones with the bruises, so, and the worms.
So what's a Texan know about Northeast apples?
Obviously, absolutely nothing.
You got it. But now you know more.
But what do y'all know about steers?
Not much.
Ooh. I know they can hurt if they
sure can.
If they get you.
Oh yeah.
You ever ride a bull?
No, I have not.
You ridden horses?
Oh, of course.
You like horse riding?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but no bull riding.
You know, not yet.
All right,
that's maybe a little later.
All right, I think that's a good deal.
A mechanical bull, absolutely.
You've ridden a mechanical bull?
Oh, of course.
Okay, all right, but I think now you got to do the real thing.
Only if you come with me.
I'll come with you. We'll go. No mechanical bulls, real bulls.
Deal.
Okay. Hey, listen. So, you know what? Let's change a little bit, because one of the things that was sad about, I mean, apple picking and all that is a wonderful, actually, it's intriguing. It's a great part of American tradition, especially in the Northeast. It's become even more and more, and it's a great thing where families do it, and kind of puts you in touch. A lot of urban people love doing it because they go out and they get in touch with nature a little bit, and it's kind of a nice thing to do. So it's a great thing. Unfortunately, there's other things that are like you that become, unfortunately, also part of our experience, and that's like gun violence and shooting. And I mean, so it's incredible, you know, that we again and again we hear examples of, you know, people taking a gun and going someplace, and they do a lot of different stuff. So, you know, mass shootings in a single incident, they really have been over 1,000 of those since 2013. Mm-hmm. And mass shooting, maybe most people don't think, but we're talking about more than four people at a time. I mean, it doesn't have to be hundreds, but, you know, where there's a group killing, which over 1,000 of those in the past, like, you know, 3 or 4 years. That's really staggering. And so kind of today we're going to speak on, first we're going to speak with somebody who's an expert on mental health and violence and, you know, what connection these might have in kind of being a factor in these mass shootings. And then we're going to hear from somebody, a father who was impacted personally back when in 2007 there was a shooting at Virginia Tech. And when his daughter was killed in that attack. So it's an important reality that we're dealing with. And so I'm delighted that we're going to be speaking with people who can kind of help us to understand this a little better and, you know, maybe even give us some ideas how we might impact this. So our first guest is Jeff Swanson, who is a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. Professor Swanson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and I must say I'm way smarter about apple picking than I was 20 minutes ago.
Well, actually, you know, when we talk about serious things, as we're going to do with mental health and violence, I do think it's important to kind of realize that, you know, in a lot of what we talk about, the glass is both half full and half empty.
Right.
You know, there's a lot going on. And actually, you know, you went to school up in Connecticut, up in New Haven, and actually where I was picking apples was probably only a half hour away from where you went to school in New Haven.
Great, and you handled that New York-Connecticut thing very diplomatically. I also went to school in California, but that would be comparing apples and oranges.
Ah, boo, boo. You know, and Angie here, who makes sure that we all can be heard right, she wants us to go bull riding down in Texas because they don't do apples in Texas. They just do steers down in Texas. Right. They do a little oil down there, too, don't you, Angie? Yeah, we can't ride oil, though. That doesn't make sense.
You don't want to ride an oil rig.
No.
That would not end up too well.
You don't want to do that. So which neck of the woods did you grow up in?
Well, I was born in Minnesota.
Okay.
But I didn't live there very long. And I moved as a young child to Ecuador, where my father was a medical missionary. And he was one of two doctors who staffed a 20-bed hospital out in the jungle of Ecuador. And that was my early experience.
Wow, that's fascinating. Did you like it while you were there?
Well, I did. It was I think it was a wonderful place to grow up. My mother was a teacher, and she taught my brother and me, and then we moved to the larger city of Quito. But I think it was a great place to grow up, and it gave me a sense of how big the world is, and you know how different people are, and all that's wonderful. And then I came back to the United States for my college education.
How long were you there, and what how old were you when you were down in Ecuador?
I moved there when I was I think 4 years old, and came back to attend third grade in a suburban elementary school in Minneapolis, which was kind of like coming back from Mars or something in terms of how
so,
I was.
So you both speak Spanish and you speak Minnesotan.
Right. I think exactly. And both are a little rusty at this point.
So what got you interested in the current field that you're teaching about and that you're studying? What got you interested in this area?
Well, I'm a sociologist. I'm a social scientist who focuses on the phenomenon of mental illness in populations, kind of from a public health perspective and trying to think about it in terms of the social environment as well as individual characteristics of people who have mental illnesses. And I have spent my career as an applied sociologist. I'm in a psychiatry department trying to do research to build evidence for interventions and policies and laws that will improve outcomes for people with serious mental illnesses in the United States. And there is a little bit of a connection to violent behavior that comes up because a small proportion of people with mental illnesses might be at risk of harming others or themselves. And thereby might have different needs, and there might be different issues concerning risk to the public. So I kind of got into it by studying mental illness in populations. And then I have encountered this other whole problem, which is firearms-related injury and gun violence, as a kind of connected to that tangentially, but it gets lots of attention when there's a mass casualty shooting.
Well, Professor Swanson, I'm delighted because here's what I know about the sociology of mental illness. So I want to learn a lot. You may learn a little bit about apples, but I want to learn a lot more about what you know. I remember 4 million years ago when I took a course in sociology. I remember to this day the book that we had to read by a professor called Thomas Szasz called Stigma. And basically, the whole notion about how mental illness was treated as such a stigma, unlike a broken leg or unlike a heart attack, that mental illness had such a stigma attached to it that almost amplified the illness. Has anything changed?
Well, I don't think so. And that's actually very related to the problem with respect to violence. You know, if you do a public opinion poll in this country, that somewhere between 50 and 60% of the adults in this country believe that people with mental illnesses are likely or very likely to be dangerous, to be violent. And if we believe that, then we will act accordingly, and we will seek social distance from people with mental illnesses and maybe treat them with scorn and maybe support public policies that restrict their liberties unnecessarily. We might discriminate against people with mental illnesses in the distribution of the benefits and opportunities and rights in our society.
Now,
I think it's important to know. Yeah.
Now, Professor Swanson, What you say, I think, is so absolutely true. And I mean, I can tell you something I've been dealing with in the past month or so is that in the issue of street homelessness, you know, a lot of people homeless because they don't have enough money to pay the rent, and they wind up not. So there is the issue of just people who are poor. They don't have the money to pay the rent. Then there's also the issue that some of the people on the street have some substance abuse problems, and some of the people on the street have mental illnesses. And when you're looking to figure out if you're going to kind of have a place where maybe some people can stay, one of the issues that always gets raised, and it get raised both legitimately and maybe sometimes overstated, but okay, so if somebody has a mental illness, are they going to be violent with the staff or the volunteers who are working with them? So I think the issue you raise is critical because we got to understand better what's going on with those with mental illnesses.
Well, what I'd like your listeners to hear, first of all, about that is that the studies show, and I've been involved in this research over decades now, is that people with serious mental illnesses, for the most part, are not violent. The vast majority of people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, are not violent towards others and never will be. There is a relative risk that's elevated compared to people who don't have serious mental illnesses. But relative risk doesn't mean that the majority of people who have those illnesses are going to be violent. Now, there are other factors that come together. Violent behavior is very complicated. It's caused by many different things that all come together, a whole cocktail of factors. One is substance abuse. So if you add substance abuse to serious psychopathology, it might exacerbate or make worse a symptom such as excessive threat perception. It might also disinhibit people's aggressive impulses. It might also expose people to toxic influences in the social environment, such as getting involved in illegal drug markets and so on. So, yeah, people who have serious mental illnesses that impair their ability to reason and regulate mood need treatment and need care. And in our society, we can talk about this, but in my view, the mental health care system that we have, if you can, you know, even call it a system, is woefully inadequate. It's overburdened. It's fragmented. It's under-resourced. It doesn't work very well for many people. And there's a whole story about deinstitutionalization and people involved in the criminal justice system and so on. But I think that system, we really, as a humane thing for society to do, should reform it, should reinvest in it. But let me hasten to add, if we did that, that's not going to solve our violence problem. That is a different problem that intersects just on its edges with mental illness.
Professor Swanson, we're going to take a break. Can you stay with us for a couple of minutes when we come back after the break?
Happy to do that.
Great. Professor Jeff Swanson, who is a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. And we've been talking about mental illness. And one of the things that we've talked about is, you know, there's a stereotype or a stigma out there that, boy, violence is rampant among those who have mental illness. And as Professor Swanson pointed out, not so much. It's most people with very severe mental illness are not threatening or violent to others. But we'll talk more about that when we come back. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us in 2 minutes when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And we say just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Unfortunately, there's a lot of violence in the world. There's a lot of challenges. We also sometimes deal with mental health issues, and we kind of think that all people with mental illnesses are violent, which is not the reality. And so we're talking with professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University, Jeff Swanson. Professor Swanson, thanks again for being on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
So now talk to us a little bit about gun violence.
Well, we do have a serious problem with gun violence in the United States. It claims the lives of about 32,000 people every year. So if you think about it, on the tragic day last week when the 10 people died in Oregon, 92 other people died on the same day. And we didn't hear about them. In suicides, more than half are suicides, 92 other people as a result of a gunshot, I should say. So it's suicides, it's intimate partner domestic violence incidents, it's gang shootings. And we tend to focus on gun violence when there is a horrifying mass casualty shooting. And we should, in a sense. But the problem is that the mass shooter is atypical. We've just mentioned how they're atypical of people with mental illness, the vast majority of whom are nonviolent. They're also atypical of the perpetrators of gun crime. So that kind of becomes that mass shooter, the prism through which we look at these two intersecting public health problems. And I think that's unfortunate sometimes because it distorts our vision of both of them. And I don't mean to take away from the fact that mass shootings are horrifying and very disturbing events, and people say, well, you know, is the mass shooter mentally ill? I mean, on the face of it, you don't have to be a psychiatry professor to know this is the act of a disturbed individual. In my view, we're not going to have a world where people we don't have anyone who is inclined to harm others at a time like that, but I think we shouldn't have to live in a world where they have such easy access to such an efficient killing technology as a firearm. And we could talk about that if you like.
Well, you know, I would. I mean, it seems to me that when we talk about 32,000 deaths by guns, we're talking about non-accidental ones?
Well, there are non-accidental ones. There are. That's a tiny, tiny proportion of them. You know, the last year for which we have data from the CDC, 11,208 homicides, 21,175 suicides. Okay. Now, compare that, 505 unintentional shootings. And then there are 400 and some that are police shootings, law enforcement, and all. And then there are 84,000 non-fatal gun injuries. And most of them are not self-harm because people don't survive often when they use a gun to try to harm themselves.
Right. So if we, I mean, again, for what you just said, it is anybody who engaged in mass shooting on the surface, would you say that that person does have a mental illness?
Well, it depends on what we mean by mental illness. They certainly don't all have a diagnosable illness such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major depression. Some of them do. Probably people with serious mental illnesses are somewhat overrepresented in that group. It's hard to tell because there's this reporting bias. If you look back historically, it could be that the incidents that we hear about that are reported more often tend to, you know, have serious mental illnesses. But certainly, if you just look at the tracking databases that looked at mass shootings, in recent years, lots of those individuals have not been reported to have one of these kinds of major illnesses that I've mentioned. What they might have, though, is some kind of a personality disorder. They might have problems that relate to their upbringing. One of the serious risk factors for not only this, but other kinds of criminal offending is people who, when they're growing up, are subject to violent victimization or exposed to violence around them. When they're trying to, you know, develop an attack personality, if they're being victimized and beaten up, that's not a good thing for someone to grow up And so which translates into, I think, a policy imperative. If we want to get upstream and address the social determinants of violence, we need to figure out how to have healthier communities where fewer kids are exposed to trauma who then grow up to be perpetrators.
Now, that's, obviously, but how do you do that?
It's a long-term project. I would say that in terms of public policy, I mean, there are different ways of thinking about it, but in terms of public policy, if you think about violence as kind of an infectious disease in communities, I think if we had a better social safety net, if we had better access to substance abuse treatment when people needed it, better opportunities for people, we don't think of those things as violence prevention strategies, but I think they're part of it. And I hasten to say, this is not a one-thing problem, and it's not a one-thing solution. So while we're thinking about violent behavior, I mean, to have gun violence, you need two things. You need a dangerous person and a gun. In theory, if we didn't have anybody inclined to harm others or themselves, we could have lots of guns. We wouldn't have gun violence. That's not the world that we live in. So we need to think about the behaviors, but also about the access to lethal means. And that's a big opportunity for saving lives with respect to suicide as well as homicide.
Now, let me ask you quick, because I think one of the challenges I think we face as a society is, if somebody has a heart attack, you kind of know whether they live, whether they die. You put in a stent, you do angioplasty, stuff like that, and you kind of can track the outcomes pretty clearly. Mental illness has softer metrics to measure it. But from your kind of looking at the sociology of mental illness, does treatment work? Can we actually help people with mental illness to live better lives?
Well, I would say yes, but I would qualify that. I think that we need more research to develop both a better understanding of the underlying causes of mental illness, and how they interact with exposures to the environment over time. We also need better treatment technologies. The treatments that we have now in terms of, say, pharmacotherapies for people, there are lots of people who don't benefit from them, many who do. But it's an area where, we need science, but also we need to think about the situation that people are in who have serious mental illnesses and think about how we actually reach out to them. If you look at what was happening in the middle of the 20th century, 500,000 people with serious mental illnesses were locked up in asylums. Now, very, very few, relatively speaking, are in institutional care. They're in the community. But many times need, housing and supported employment and need support to recover as in addition to perhaps the medical treatment. It's not the case that that mental health treatment doesn't work at all, but it's also the case that we need to do much better, not only in developing better treatments and interventions, but also in better ways to deliver the care and to reach out to people.
Professor Swanson, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and our listeners here on Just Love. I think your comments, your observations were very, very helpful in kind of helping our listeners to understand that some of the stigma surrounding mental illness is probably not accurate when it comes to violence. Also to realize that mental illness kind of comes out of communities, and the more we have healthy communities, the better it is for all of us. So I want to thank you, Professor Swanson, for being with us, and thanks so much, and good luck in your work, and thanks for what you do.
Well, thank you, Monsignor Sullivan. It was my pleasure to be with you.
This is Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. When we come back, we're going to be speaking again, this time very, very personally about gun violence. We're going to be speaking with Peter Reed, who lost a daughter in the gun violence at Virginia Tech. So join us when we come back in 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, Just Love. Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. We speak with those people who try to make our world more just, try to make it more compassionate. We're going to be speaking now with Peter Reed, who is a retired Air Force lieutenant, colonel, and he now is a consultant with the government. And tragically, he lost his daughter in a gun violence incident in at Virginia Tech. Peter Reed, thank you so much for being with us.
Monsignor, thanks for having me.
Great. So the tragedy in your life is one that that had a great deal of impact in helping you or kind of imposing you to deal with the issue of guns in this country. Want to share with our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. As you noted, my daughter Mary was one of 32 students and faculty who were shot to death on the campus of Virginia Tech on April 16th. 2007, and losing a child in a family at any time is a shock and a tragedy, and it's unnatural. But to lose a child in that way is probably the most unnatural death I can think of. And so I felt compelled, and many people in my situation have felt compelled both before and since to take what action I could to try and ensure that nobody else would ever have to be in the position my daughter was in or the position we're in again. And it's over the last 8 years motivated me to take action in many different ways.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. You know, as someone who looks at what's going on and trying to deal with issues of gun control, I ask a very simple question. Since that time, has we made any progress?
I think we have made some progress. We have made some progress on the, if you're talking in the political realm, we've made some progress on the state level in various states where some bad legislation, in my estimation, has been defeated, and some good legislation has actually passed or even been passed by referenda in the states. At the federal level, it's been harder. I was in the Senate gallery in 2013 in the wake of the Newtown shooting when the Senate couldn't even bring a modified background check bill to a vote, let alone do anything about it. I think if you're talking the broader society and in the culture, I think there is a change happening. I think that's been underway for some time, and I think you're seeing the expression of it now in the wake of a summer of both high-profile gun violence and the gun violence that we have every day. Of course, the latest being the community college in Oregon.
How would you kind of describe the change that you see going on?
I think a lot more people are now willing to talk about the issue that weren't willing to talk about it before. A lot of people shy away from the issue. Partly because I think it's hard for them to imagine it happening to them. Some act out of conviction, some act out of political expediency, but I think a lot of people have taken a fresh look at it and decided there's no longer room to stand on the sidelines and pretend we can't do anything. The numbers are pretty staggering. When you look at the numbers in a year of what happens, we have over 108,000 people who were shot in murders, assaults, suicide attempts, unintentional shootings. That's 32,000 people who die every year. And we have a Virginia Tech every day in this country of people who are murdered by gun. And most people either don't have any idea or grossly underestimate that number. So I think people are waking up to it and feeling that they have to do something.
You know, I think it just keeps happening. I mean, I listened last week, I think, when there was a shooting out in the northwest of the country, and I was in the car and I was listening to the radio and I heard President Obama, and you could just hear a certain exasperation in his voice about that. And I guess, you know, part of what I kind of feel with regard to all of these things is from a legislative point of view, it doesn't seem to make any difference because, and again, you know, when I look at the politics, it, as you said, you were in the Senate and they couldn't even bring something up for a vote. It seems to me a very sad and a very difficult situation right. that we find ourselves in.
So I think the change has to come from the society, from the bottom up to the politicians. And I was very pleased to note that Archbishop Supich from Chicago had a piece that ran in the Chicago Tribune on gun violence and saying it's time to take meaningful and swift action. I was really impressed by that, and I wish the prophetic voice of the church would get heard more on this. And, I, you know, it's the laity that's out there doing it. I wish we would see more of a voice coming from the ordained and religious. Could I share with you just the quote he had at the end?
Please.
He said, "It's no longer enough for those of us involved in civic leadership and pastoral care to comfort the bereaved and bewildered families of victims of gun violence. It's time to heed the words of Pope Francis. Take meaningful and swift action to address violence in our society. We must band together to call for gun control legislation. We must act in ways that promote the dignity and value of human life, and we must do it now." And I thought that was incredibly powerful, and I think that's the sense that people are developing now.
And, you know, I think, you know, I share with you the fact that that's very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. I also, again, with a little bit of sadness, say it comes out of Chicago. And isn't the issue in Wyoming and Nevada and Colorado? It's not in Chicago and New York.
It's an issue everywhere.
No. When you look at who blocks legislation, it's sure. not New Yorkers and Illinois.
I live in Virginia,
right?
And I go to Richmond every year.
Right.
You know, we go to the General Assembly. you know, again and again, I've been to states. I used to live in Texas. I was down there this spring. I've been out to Montana to speak to the Joint Committee of their legislature on the issue of getting mental health records into the background check system. And again, you know, in Colorado, they were successful in passing what I consider
and the people and the legislators got defeated.
But it's still there, and yeah. and the law is in place, and it's working. And those are people, you know, that I commend for taking a political risk, you know, doing what they believe is right and what I believe is the right thing. But I don't think that politicians necessarily take the right lesson when they look at that and say, "Well, I can't do this." Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia, has consistently had an F rating from the NRA ever since he was the mayor of Richmond. He was the governor of Virginia, is now the senator from Virginia, and taking a stand on gun violence issues hasn't hurt him at all in Virginia. So, I think that's kind of a rebuttable presumption.
Well, yeah, it's rebuttable in by the exceptions. Those things happen. Is good examples that at least something can happen.
Sure.
But why do you think? I mean, I just don't get it. You've been involved in this. Why are, you know, organizations? Let's be real frank, like the NRA, which is kind of a rifle association. Why is it almost like any piece of control is bad? It's not an issue of reasonable. It's just right. Anything is bad. Why is that?
That's an issue of the leadership and the extremists that are leading that organization. I have a lot of friends who are either our NRA members or previous NRA members who agree with reasonable proposals and reasonable legislation, but the leadership of the organization is not interested in compromise. They're not interested in working out reasonable solutions. They're interested in whipping up the membership with kind of straw man arguments about, you know, confiscating guns or the Second Amendment or you name it. None of which I'm not interested in taking away any law-abiding owner's guns. I'm not interested in, you know, undercutting the Second Amendment.
I'm not a constitutional.
Sure.
A scholar at all, and therefore I have no qualms about saying the fact that to me the Second Amendment really clear. It's got to do with militia.
Sure.
It doesn't got to do with individual citizens owning guns, but I say that with full disclaimer that I'm not a constitutional lawyer, with a full disclaimer that the Supreme Court said differently, but I can read English, and it seems to me this is about militia.
Sure.
And it's now been interpreted that people can walk around with, you know, with everything and do what they want. So it is sad, but thank you for what you're doing. What's on your agenda for to take steps forward?
Well, we're going to continue to work here in Virginia locally, as it were, going down to Richmond to work with the General Assembly, work with Governor McAuliffe, who's been great on the issue, and then at the national level continue to work with Congress and support the president or the executive branch in taking executive actions that they can do without force of law, you know, without additional legislation. For example, right now it's against federal law for people that don't have the right kind of state permit to be armed within 1,000 feet of a school, but because the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms hasn't said which permits would allow that, and basically anybody that can get a permit from any state, you know, can kind of talk themselves out of it. So the ATF and the executive branch could easily clarify that, and that wouldn't take any legislation at all. So there are things like that can be done immediately, and then we're going to continue to work. There are bills pending right now in Congress on universal background checks. Senator Kaine has one introduced to make people who are selling guns or transferring guns more responsible for knowing who they are selling or transferring to. And I think legislative fixes like that are doable.
Yeah. Peter Reed, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and sharing with you, you know, part of your own tragedy, which motivated you now to do things which are going to work for the common good. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Well, thank you for having me, Monsignor.
You know, I think, Tom, the conversation we had today with both Peter Reed and with Professor Swanson points out a little bit of the importance and the complexity of these issues. And, you know, again, we talk about, why do we talk about these on Just Love? Because, obviously, protecting life is important, that if we can decrease violence, that is terribly important. And as Peter Reed pointed out, the Archbishop of Chicago pointed out how, from a Catholic social teaching perspective, we want policies that are going to kind of do their piece to protect the common good, that are going to protect innocent lives. And you know, his putting forth that gun control is one of those things that would foster that common good is one of the reasons we, you know, we talk about it. And I do think what I think Professor Swanson said, okay, people kill people. People kill people with guns. And if you kind of can deal with both sides of the equation, mm-hmm. how do you reduce the presence of guns? How do you reduce the anger, the inappropriate behavior? Well, you got to deal with it in both ways, and it's very, very difficult. Angie, certainly, you know, in the part of the world you come from Texas, there is, you know, a lot of hunting, a lot of talk, a lot of presence of guns in your part of the
mm-hmm.
world. Did you?
Yeah, there are.
Did you in? But Austin is probably not the most gun part of Texas, right?
Not the most, but a lot of people do have their concealed handgun license.
And do you need a concealed handgun license in Austin?
Do I need one?
Not to you, but I mean, does
personally.
One need one?
No. If you want to have a gun in your car or carry it with you, yes, legally you need one, but you don't need one to feel safe.
Okay. No, but I guess, but you do need permits and you do need things like
oh,
that.
Yes. And you need hunting permits and everything. I mean, I grew up with guns, so I'm really comfortable with them.
Did you go hunting?
I don't like to kill animals. Mm. I'll shoot snakes if they're very poisonous. You know, so I mean, I'll do that, but I don't like to kill animals.
Have you ever shot a snake?
Yeah, I have. A coral snake.
Yeah?
It was in my backyard.
Wow.
Well, it's me or the snake, and it's... The snake's
wow.
gone. I'm not.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. That's a good thing. Tom, any news?
We do, Monsignor. You know, before we were talking a little bit, obviously, about mental health care. And just this past week, We talked to us about human dignity always on Just Love, and we have to remember that this past weekend, the World Health Organization had declared on World Mental Health Day that this year's theme that they were going to be pursuing for the coming year is dignity and mental health. So the World Health Organization is going to be doing that by trying to encourage people to get proper training in mental health care of professionals, the special needs of those with mental health issues, respect for informed consent and treatment and inclusion and decision-making process, and also public information campaigns that do a little bit about what Dr. Swanson and you were talking about, kind of making people less afraid of mental illness. I think you mentioned that word stigma, and I still think that stigma still sticks around mental illness, and I think that that's something that we have to be aware of, and that it impacts human dignity.
Well, and again, I think let's kind of end a little bit on this note, because we've talked about violence, we've talked about how mental illness can lead to violence, but and how that's rare. But there is a lot of examples in our world of people who suffer from mental illnesses that are really held back, and it does impact negatively their families, it impacts themselves, it impacts their colleagues at work, their friends. And, you know, just as there is no reason why anybody who's got high blood pressure doesn't go to a doctor to get some help. You know, somebody who's dealing with some emotional issues, there should not be a stigma attached with going to get that help, but there is. And so I do think one of the things that our listeners may want to kind of consider thinking about and doing is, if there is somebody in one's family, a colleague at work, be very supportive about encouraging them to get the help that they need, that there shouldn't be a stigma associated with it. But it is a very, very difficult thing, because somehow, you know, we say to people, well, snap out of it, you know, just kind of get a grip on yourselves, go forward. But you know, we don't say that for somebody who's having a heart attack. You know, we don't say that for somebody who's got a broken leg. We say, get help. We'll get you help. We'll bring you to the hospital. And it's kind of a similar thing when people have emotional problems, that there is ways that they can get help. You know, in this day and age, sometimes it's by, you know, talking, through counseling, through therapy. Sometimes that's coupled with the use of drugs, sometimes not. But, you know, while it is a little bit harder to measure, it is a reality that a lot of people do tremendously well in moving forward with their lives by getting the help that they need. So I think one of the things we should try to do is to avoid stigmatizing people with mental illness, encouraging people to move forward, encouraging them to get the help they need and be supportive as they're moving forward in their lives. And it's something that I think we can do as a society. And, you know, and in those few cases where it does turn violence, we need to make sure that we also provide support to prevent that from happening. So anyway, so this is Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and make our world more just and make it more compassionate. Thank you for being with us on Just Love. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.